KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm David Hyde. The presidential debates are a major factor in this year's race for the White House. So when did the debates become such a big deal? Joining us with much more about the debates and American presidents is author Kenneth Davis. His books are the Don't Know Much About series of books, and the latest installment is called Don't Know Much About the American Presidents. Kenneth Davis, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Good afternoon, David.
So when was the first major presidential debate?
Well, if we're talking about just presidential debates, they're 1960. That's a surprise to a lot of people who think that, oh, we must have been doing this for hundreds of years. George Washington must have been debating from the very get-go. But in fact, the Nixon-Kennedy debates, televised in first in September of 1960, four debates, were not only the first televised debates, but the first presidential debates. A lot of people think of 1858 and Lincoln-Douglas, but that was actually a debate for a Senate race, and of course, not televised.
And yet, that one had a big influence on the ultimate outcome of for Lincoln later on. What was the Lincoln-Douglas debate about?
That's correct. It was very, very important for Lincoln. The debate, there were actually six debates. They were held around the state of Illinois, and of course, this is the obviously the time before mass media, but the telegraph existed. There was one issue, essentially, slavery, or what the future of slavery was going to be in the new territories. This was the only political issue that counted in the 1850s, and it was the only issue in this Illinois Senate race. And I should also point out that even though they were debating this for a Senate seat, the people didn't actually vote on it in those days. The Senate in the 19th century was still chosen by the state legislature. So they did have this series of debates. Lincoln's ideas and words were carried around the country through telegraph into newspapers, and it really did establish his national reputation as a significant figure. And 2 years later, he is the Republican nominee and faces three other contenders in the famous election of 1860, one of whom is Stephen Douglas, the man he debates in Illinois.
Well, I want to hear just a brief excerpt from not the original Lincoln-Douglas debates, but here's a dramatic rendition. First, we're going to hear the words of Stephen Douglas, followed by Abraham Lincoln.
We'll leave the people, according to the Nebraska bill, free to do as they please on the subject of slavery and every other question.
I leave it to you to say whether, in the history of our government, this institution of slavery has not always failed to be a bond of union, and on the contrary, been an apple of discord and an element of division in the House.
And as you said, slavery was the big issue there in the debate between Lincoln and Douglas. One of the things that I was thinking about listening back to it, and of course, this is a really long debate, but, you know,
well, there were six of them, first of all.
Right.
That's one of the things. And people were much more accustomed to listening to men speak for several hours at a time. That's what you did for fun in those days. Edward Everett, for instance, was a famous orator who would speak 2 and 3 hours, and people went to hear such people speak at that time. So it wasn't unusual for a crowd to be kind of enthralled by two men talking for a long time.
And that brings me to my question, which is nowadays a lot of times when you hear pundits talking about a debate, it's almost like they're rating a theater performance or some other kind of performance. How much did that play a role when people were talking about the Lincoln-Douglas debate of 1858?
Well, surprisingly, a lot. Even Stephen Douglas himself, before the debates begin, says to some of his colleagues, "We'll have to be careful. He's full of facts and figures and can tell a great story." So it was style as well as substance back then. It was who you were as well as what you were saying, how you presented yourself, and this was certainly part of Lincoln's appeal. Back east, he was still seen as something of a country bumpkin hayseed lawyer in some respects, and this series of of debates where he was so well-spoken and did make such an impressive public appearance really did elevate him not only in his native state but across the country. And one of the reasons that he goes on to become the party's nominee in 1860.
We're talking about presidential debates the day after the big presidential debate last night. And author Kenneth Davis is with us. He's telling us about the history of presidential debates and also about his new book, Don't Know Much About the American Presidents. And you actually grade the presidents in this book and, of course, give Lincoln one of the highest grades, an A+. What were his biggest strengths?
I think that I reduce it to, without oversimplifying it, his humor, his humanity, and his humility. Those are three things that most presidents would do well to emulate, and it's difficult. As a writer, I also believe that Lincoln was the greatest writer of American presidents, but he also did have an extraordinary ability to bring together, as famously noted in one recent book, a team of rivals. He could draw in men who he had been battling against for the nomination to be part of his cabinet. And that's an indication, I think, of many of the best presidents, the greatest presidents, do surround themselves by greatness. And perhaps it's a recognition that they are comfortable enough in their own egos that they don't have to worry about having strong egos around them. And that's something we sometimes forget or overlook in ranking some of these presidents. I do give all 43 men who've been in the office a letter grade from A+ down to F with a few incompletes. And as you said, Lincoln is one of the four A+ presidents.
Team of Rivals, that's the Doris Kearns Goodwin book, right, about Abraham Lincoln. What were Lincoln's biggest flaws?
Lincoln's biggest flaws, you know, that's an interesting question. I think that he, like many presidents, was sure of himself and certain that what he was doing was the right course. He was able to switch tracks and switch gears. So even when he ran into his own belief that he had the right course, he was able to see it. I think that probably in his own time, there were certainly men like Frederick Douglass who saw him as a little bit too moderate in his views. I think the other surprising thing is we, of course, think of him as the great emancipator. But if you look back and examine his views, for instance, in those 1858 debates, as opposed to modern day, you'd be surprised at some of his views. We think of him, of course, as the great emancipator, but Lincoln was saying things in the debates like black and white people shouldn't mingle, there should be no intermarriage, blacks shouldn't serve on juries. He was also still at that point a believer that slavery would end in America. He didn't have a timeline or a deadline for that, but he also believed that the solution after emancipation was that African Americans would return to Africa, a policy known as colonization. So that's not the most progressive of views, but certainly for his time, he was very progressive.
We're talking about Abraham Lincoln with author Kenneth Davis and about the history of presidential debates and about his new book, Don't Know Much About the American Presidents. Kenneth Davis, you also rank two presidents in the 1850s with the letter grade F. And these might be presidents that folks have never heard of. Millard Fillmore is one of them, and also Franklin Pierce both get Fs. Why Fs?
Well, actually, and there's a third, James Buchanan. It's not a coincidence that these are the three presidents who lead up to Abraham Lincoln,
yes.
Coincidentally. These are the three men who are in office basically from 1850 to 1860, and they have to be viewed as failures for their complete inability to do anything to avert the coming disaster in America. Not only in some cases did they fail to do something to avert it, but they may have hastened the arrival of the Civil War and hastened the deep sense of division that for which there was no compromise. A greater leader in those 10 years might have done something to avert this terrible tragedy from occurring. Of course, 150 years ago now, we are marking the commemorating the Civil War. 600,000 is the lowball estimate. It goes up as high as 800,000 Americans died in fighting in those 4 years. That's an astonishing number in its own right. 2% of the American population. We'd be talking about more than 6 million people dying today, of course. And so that was the crisis that Lincoln was faced with when he takes office. And immediately the crisis explodes because with his election, the southern states begin to secede from the Union.
Kenneth Davis talking about his new book, Don't Know Much About the American Presidents. I wanted to fast forward to this debate of 1960 that you referenced earlier. But first, I mean, even though Lincoln Douglas isn't a presidential debate, it was a big deal. You know, as you say, influenced who ultimately becomes president in 1860. Why no debates, until 1960?
Well, partly because of the way people saw politics in the 19th century. It wasn't seemly for people to go out, and it wasn't what gentlemen did to go out on the campaign trail that we think of today. So people typically, presidential nominees, more typically sat at home on their front porch and would greet visitors, including journalists, and they would be interviewed or asked questions, and they would give a few answers. Their supporters would be doing all the actual campaigning, whether that was fire torchlight rallies and singing and much more mass campaigning by groups of people in those days. With the train comes along the idea of the whistle stop campaign, where candidates actually do go out and start to travel from one city to the next, give a stump speech, wave from the caboose, and move on. With radio, things start to change. Certainly FDR was a master of the radio, as we know from his fireside chats. But many of these candidates didn't really want to debate their opponents. Certainly Franklin Roosevelt had no interest in debating anyone, because why give a platform to an opponent? There was also a very important rule passed in the 1930s that applied first to radio and then television, called the Equal Time Rule. And this meant that broadcasters had to give each and every candidate the same amount of time. That meant every single minority party candidate would have to be given equal time. In 1960, that equal time rule was set aside by Congress so that they could have the 1960 Kennedy-Nixon debate. In 1976, the rule was again set aside for the Ford Carter debates.
Well, but so why did Nixon and Kennedy agree to do it?
That's a good question. I think that in Nixon's case, he felt fairly confident in his skills as a debater. After all, in 1952, he had made a very famous speech called the Checkers Speech, in which he defended himself against rumors and claims of campaign scandal and a slush fund. And then in 1959, he'd also made even a bigger splash with the so-called kitchen debate in Moscow with Nikita Khrushchev, the Soviet premier. These gave Nixon the sense that he was very capable of handling himself on the television stage. John F. Kennedy, we have to remember, looking back, was then the junior senator from Massachusetts, not really nationally well-known. Nixon was a well-known figure going back to the debates in Congress over Alger Hiss and the Un-American Affairs Committee. So he was familiar to the American public. John F. Kennedy felt that this would be a good way to introduce himself to the American public, but also give people a sense that he could stand on an equal stage with Richard Nixon, who, of course, had been the vice president for 8 years and was a well-known quantity.
And what happened in that debate?
Well, in the first one, it's quite interesting. Nixon had been sick and actually in the hospital. He lost a lot of weight. So when he got on stage, he was wearing a suit that was kind of ill-fitting. He also had hurt his knee, coincidentally, in an accident. So he was leaning on the podium because he couldn't put his full weight on his knee. And then the last and perhaps most famous aspect of this was he had a kind of notorious 5 o'clock shadow, and they tried to cover it up with something called lazy shave, a kind of pancake makeup, and it actually made him look worse. Kennedy, on the other hand, had been in California, had been rested. He was tanned, although tan doesn't come across on black and white TV. But certainly, this was an incredible victory of style. Not over substance, but style on itself. Kennedy presented himself. He was on stage with Nixon. He looked comfortable. He looked presidential. And that's the impression that people took away from that debate. Most people could not tell you, you know, the line that was said that night. But Kennedy was trailing by as many as 6 points before that debate. That debate put him ahead. There were three more in that election cycle that they were kind of seen as standoffs. So the debate wasn't what got John F. Kennedy elected, but it certainly elevated him in the minds of the American people as a person of presidential stature, and it also really made television king in terms of making presidents. From that moment on, how you looked on television and how you came across on television was going to be as important as any piece of your platform.
And what grade do you end up giving John F. Kennedy as president?
John F. Kennedy gets a B, and of course he was killed before the finish of his first full administration and didn't have a chance to run again. The big question, of course, is what he would have done in terms of Vietnam. He had had two major crises in his presidency. First, the Bay of Pigs invasion, a complete fiasco, then followed up 50 years ago this week by the Cuban Missile Crisis, in which his leadership has been routinely proclaimed as sterling. This is the moment that he takes the United States truly to the brink of nuclear war. And much, much more has been learned about those 13 days in October, as they're known, since then. But that for that moment of bringing the United States to the brink of war and then being able to pull it back is what has really raised Kennedy in the estimation of many historians. On other issues, he was kind of soft. On civil rights, for instance, he was not really willing to challenge some of the Deep South segregationists in the Democratic Party. He knew he needed their votes, and he wasn't ready to go there yet. That's one of the reasons he had gone back to Texas in 1963 to shore up support among Southern Democrats.
I got just about a minute and a half left, but can you say anything in general about whether or not good debaters end up becoming good presidents?
Well, that's a good question. I think that, you know, Ronald Reagan clearly was a good debater in the sense that he had some of the classic moments in recent debates, and the lines are now, of course, part of political legend. There you go again. Ask yourself, are you better off now than you were 4 years ago? I will not make my opponent's youth and inexperience an issue in this campaign. He was a consummate performer. And so when we say being good in debates, I think being a good performer is certainly part of being a good president. Stagecraft is part of statecraft. Kennedy understood that. Reagan understood that. FDR understood that. Theodore Roosevelt, going back to the beginning of the 20th century, understood that. And that's why these men elevated the presidency to something much larger than it ever had been before. Partly it's, of course, a function of the media. I think that being good in debates really is saying I'm a good performer.
All right. Kenneth Davis, thanks so much for talking to us.
Thanks for having me.
There's much more than just the presidential debates in his new book. It's Don't Know Much About the American Presidents. From KUOW, 94.9 Seattle, I'm David Hyde.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.